day, I would do worship for the entire school, which wasn't as broad as it sounds. It was a little two-room classroom, and we had maybe 15 students. It is a little challenging to talk to a first grader and an eighth grader in the same room, but I only had one session with them. And I always tried to ask what they would like to know about the Bible, what they would, any questions that they always had, and I tried to do what they were interested in and look for. And one year after Christmas, first week of the new year, I asked them what they would like in this particular new year and what they might want to study. And one girl, about fourth or fifth grade, yells over all of the rest of them that were yelling, "I want to study Judges." Usually not what you hear, but the lower grade teacher, who's also the principal, she kind of told me what was going to happen. That this girl had been in Bible time insisting on wanting to read and study the book of Judges. So I said, "Well, how would you like me to handle it?" She goes, "Well, I want to see what you're going to do." So I handled it. We just started in the book of Judges. It was a very interesting semester. Very interesting semester. I'm not sure that Sabbath school sometimes isn't even a place for the book of Judges, but, you know, here we are. It was really interesting. So Judges, though, at least was one way that it was prescribed that God wanted Israel for government, for rule. They were ruled after Joshua by who? By Judges. It's how we memorize the books of the Bible too, right? Joshua, Judges, Ruth. Joshua, Judges, Ruth. It's how God at least in one particular place said, "This is how I want government to be able to rule in this brand new land of milk and honey that I brought you to after I released you from your slavery to Egypt." So I've been talking in the new year, I've been talking about power and paradigms of power. And I've been talking about kings and the difference between the kings of this kingdom, this fallen kingdom that we live on, and the kings, the one king of the kingdom that we're at. And as I pointed out, it's my favorite subject, so I kind of like talking about it. And in talking about kings, I thought we'd start, at least for believers, at least for Israel, to start back a little bit and look where the idea or the concept of taking an earthly king and making him king over God's children and where it starts. And of course, you know, it begins in the book of 1 and 2 Samuel. We studied the book of 1 and 2 Samuel a few years ago here. I really always wanted to be able to study within deep there. But one thing that you notice in the book is that as far as the experience between the believers are, there's a distinct group of believers in the book of 1 and 2 Samuel. There is Samuel himself, the one who actually has the presence of God with him face to face. He's one of that long lines of patriarchs and prophets that God can walk with and talk with. You have that experience going on with Samuel. And then you kind of have the rest. The leaders, the members of the kingdom, you have kind of the rest of them who actually aren't technically listening to God because they've refused this relationship. They're willing to experience God by an intercessor, be it a priest or be it a prophet. So when we studied it before, I called Israel a nation of eavesdroppers. They get to at least, at best, they're the ones eavesdropping on this relationship with Samuel. Eavesdropping on this relationship. And so there's you don't go too far along in the book of First Samuel before you realize that. The experience that God would like to experience isn't necessarily happening in the temple. By the way, the temple's corrupt when First Samuel opens. Eli's sons, who are the high priest, and the priests on down, it's completely corrupt. The temple is this system that Israel wanted in the wilderness besides coming up the mountain to talk to God. And so the eavesdroppers have a completely different experience in living this life out than the prophet himself that he does. So it's presence versus form or prescription. Living a living, breathing relationship with God versus living it based on some form of prescription. Trying to follow God by the words that were written about him or through him rather than live with him. Samuel's the only one that is doing this. So Samuel has an opinion. Samuel brings God's opinion to where this nation should be and how they are to be governed. So these two, the prophet, the presence, and the eavesdroppers, the prescription, they are going to be completely at odds when you start talking about how Israel is to be governed. Up until Samuel becomes an adult, Israel is ruled by the judges. An entire book that's dedicated to him. Without doing a deep dive into Judges, like I said, it's interesting to say the least. God begins with not one ruler after Joshua dies. Not one ruler, but a group of rulers that come along. And he tells them, he tells Judah, by the way, not a man, not the man Judah, but he tells them that it's going to be an entire tribe, if you will. They enlist another judge. And the very first thing that happens is that they defeat the Canaanites and their king, Adonai Bezek. The first judge is considered Othniel, and he steps up, not because he wants to rule Israel, he steps up because he's in love with Caleb's daughter. By the way, Caleb and Joshua never lead the nation. It's these guys, Othniel. They all had one thing in common. Let's just say that governing was not their day job. Judging was not their day job. It isn't what they aspired to do or to be. It's not what they wanted to be. It's not the way they made their living, quote unquote. Off the top of my head, a farmer who only wants to farm, a prophetess, and a general who will not go into war unless this prophetess comes with him. The illegitimate son of a prostitute. They were all designed for a particular purpose. God said, I bring them up in order to protect you from your enemies. And by the way, the enemies are being used by God to teach them a lesson of what it means to not walk and talk with him. We all know the story of Samson. I'm not sure we know anything about him before that. Why he was selected. Doesn't know why that family was selected. Except the only thing we know about him is that when he was born, they decided to raise him in a particular religious walk. They weren't elected. They didn't run for anything. Their family was not designated as a family that would rule. So bloodline had nothing to do with it. It wasn't passed on to them. They're just there. But the thing they all had in common is they were all selected by who? They were all selected by God. It begins, Judges, with two tribes that are cooperating and working together. And it ends with one of the tribes nearly being exterminated because of what has happened within that tribe. And we know the reason is their own lack of walking with God. Being pleased, if you will, being completely satisfied with being an eavesdropper rather than a walker and a talker. To be an eavesdropper, to listen to someone else's words about God and try to live the relationship that way rather than walk and talk with him in a living, breathing relationship as we have in 1 Samuel. Israel blames it on something else. Israel blames this up and down relationship all through the judges. We go along just, you know, on our own merry way, eavesdropping on Samuel's words, trying our best to do what God tells us, and then also doing our best at what some other God tells us to do. We'll just keep going. And when it gets bad enough, finally an enemy sweeps in and defeats them, and it goes up and down, up and down. Adonai, Bezek of the Philistines, the Canaanites, all of them, over hundreds of years, just pounding Israel into submission. And then a judge comes in and liberates them, and then they get pounded into submission, up and down, up and down. God knows why he's doing it. Israel blames it on something else. In those days, there was no what? There was no king in Israel. All the people did what was right where? All the people did what was right in their own eyes. Israel believes the reason that they're getting pounded by their enemies every century or so is because we don't have a what? We don't have a king. But all of our enemies do. The one thing all of our enemies have in common, besides worshiping other gods, is that they all have a king. Israel thinks that's why it's happening. God says judges. Israel saying what? King. And by the way, the last judge is the one that's responsible for making this transition. Samuel is the last judge over Israel. He appoints his sons to try to do it. That's not working out. Because it turns out, his sons are no better at doing it than Eli the high priest's sons were at doing it when Samuel was a little boy. They're as corrupt as Eli's sons are. They take bribes. And after a few centuries of this, Israel has had it. So they go to the last judge. They go to Samuel. And they present what they want to present. All the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And said to him, "You're old, and your sons do not follow in your ways. Appoint for us, therefore, a what? A king to govern us like other nations." You see what they think the problem is? It's the king. We don't have one, and they do. Appoint a king, just like everybody else, he says. Worshipping their God, just like everybody else. Let's be ruled, just like everybody else. By the way, it's not an unreasonable request. After centuries of getting pounded by your enemies and hounded by your enemies, it's not that unreasonable a request, at least on the surface. The eavesdroppers want a king. Samuel slightly disagrees. He has a different opinion. It says, "The thing displeased Samuel when they said, 'Give us a king to govern us.' So Samuel prayed to the Lord. And when Samuel heard their demand," it said, "'Give us a king to rule us,' he was what? He was crushed." How awful. That's the way the message puts it. How awful. This is a bad idea, guys. See, but Samuel has that relationship with God. And when he prays to God, guess what? God answers. "And the Lord said to Samuel, 'Listen to the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they've rejected me from being their king. Just as they have done to me from the day I brought them up out of Egypt to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so also they are doing to you, the judge that I appointed to rule over them. They're doing it to you, but really, they're doing it to me.'" This is interesting. Samuel didn't think it was awful that they wanted a king, except that it meant they didn't want him anymore. They did say it. "You aren't long for this world, old man. And your sons aren't either." God says, though, it's not you that they don't want. It's that they don't want me. And they never have. They haven't since I brought them up out of Egypt. Remember, just a few days after being freed from slavery in Egypt, he brings them to Sinai and he offers them the one thing that he always wanted to give them. Come up the mountain, he says, when you hear the ram's horn. Come on up the mountain when you hear the trumpet. And they refused. And this is the why. And this is why. This is why they are comfortable with becoming a nation of eavesdroppers. And the nation of eavesdroppers, the one that only has this prescribed, proformed relationship with God, one that's on paper, if you will, a legal relationship and nothing else, when it comes to being safe on this planet, they have a different idea of what safety looks like. They have a different idea of what power looks like. They have a different definition of what a king is. They've been this way ever since I met them, God says. See, we have free will, and we choose. And one of the first choices we have to make is what kind of relationship we're going to have with God. Either we're going to walk and talk with him and have a living, breathing relationship with him, or we are going to live by prescription. We will have only a legal relationship. We will only live by the word on the page and in the stone, and not written where? And not written on our hearts. We make that decision. They made the decision. And by the way, when you make a decision as to whether or not you want a relationship with God, either way, he's going to give you what you want. Did he want Israel to only experience him by an intercessor? Even if it was Moses? No. Moses told them that he didn't want it. But once they made their decision, what did he do? He gave it to them. As soon as it's over, as soon as that decision process is over, you go speak to him, Moses. For if he continues to speak to us, we will die. Moses says, no, that's not what he wants. But once they made that decision, God then tells Moses and lets Israel listen. He says, I want you to tell them before I say what I'm about to say next. I want you to remind them that I was the one that spoke to them from the mountain, not you. I came to them first. Now that that's been said, the next 10 chapters in Exodus is all about how to build the sanctuary, how to create the priests, how to create the furniture, the prescription for the sacrifices. When we make a decision, God honors it. He'll give you what you want. And sometimes, which makes sometimes the Hebrew Scriptures a little hard to deal with, sometimes he will also treat you like you think he is. So if you treat him like one of the foreign gods, if we treat him like he's a pagan god that's angry or so, he might just treat us the same way back. Because that's what we're expecting. Because that's what we're wanting. I want a king and not a judge. It's the relationship that he has with them. He'll give them what they want. And sometimes he will act exactly like they think he should. As I said, did he give them the sacrificial system because he wanted it? No. Did he give them the sacrificial system because he needed it? Does God need blood and sacrifice and offerings? No. Does he want it? No. I'm not saying he's not in charge. I'm not saying he's not in control. I'm just saying that he rules differently. He chose to rule differently long before you and I ever showed up on the scene. Long before the foundation of the world, he chose that he would rule this way. Love is a fundamentally different way to rule. Fundamentally. Love doesn't increase power. Love doesn't increase the size of his thumb to hold you under.
Love actually condescends. Love decreases power. Why? Because he claims that he cares. One of the first words he ever told Moses, one of the first men to ever trust him on this, I want this face-to-face relationship. So Moses had a choice when he came up the mountain. Either he could get up and off his face and talk to him like he said that he wanted to, or he could try to treat him the way that he treated all the other Egyptian gods. Moses decides to talk to him. And one of the very first things that God told him out of his own mouth, I have heard the sound of my children and their cries out, and I have come down. Not power over, condescending, coming down. Love has to be done face to face. It's required. Can't love you through somebody else. God's decided he's not going to love you through somebody else. Can we have influence? Can we truly intercede? Of course we can intercede. We can intercede in prayer. We can intercede in love and grace. By the way, it's the only way they figure out how God loves them is when his children treat them the way that God has treated them. But ultimately, everyone needs to make a decision as to whether or not they will love, and not just because my friendly neighbor does. I really make a church angry that's full of grandparents and great-grandparents when I say that God has no grandchildren. He only has children. Comes a time, parents, comes a time when our children decide whether or not they will love God. Comes a time, grandparents, when they will decide whether or not they love God. All God's children, not all God's grandkids. They wanted to back off this relationship in the priesthood, and they are going to now back it off even further by putting a monarch, by putting a king front to be able to intercede on their behalf now. They've been doing it, God said, since I called them up Sinai and they refused. They keep backing away. Love can't operate that way. And a shepherd can't operate as king that way. God says, okay though, Samuel, here's how it will be. Tell them, Samuel. Tell them how it will be. I'm going to give them what they want. Don't worry. I'm in charge. I'm in control. I'm going to give them what they want. But you tell them now how it's going to be for them as to what they're asking for. You let them know. This is what is about to happen. Listen to their voice only. You shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of what? The ways of the king who shall reign over them. You tell them now. Here are the ways, he says. So Samuel reported all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. So number one, he says, the first words should hit you. These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will, the very first thing, he will what? He will take. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run with his chariots. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands, commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. First thing the king will do is what? He will take. By the way, the judges never took anything. They weren't paid. They weren't enticed. The judges were taken from wherever they lived, went and did their job, and guess what? They went back home. First thing the king will do, he says, is what? Is take. And it involves the sons. He'll take your sons, he says. See, I used to look at this and think, well, yeah, okay, they're going to have an army. That's what they need. They want an army to be able to fight all of the enemies. They got to have this. But notice the language. This army's got nothing to do for fighting for the nation. It's got everything to do for what? To protect him. The language, running in front of his chariots. They're not fighting for the nation. They're doing what? They're protecting him. Army commanders backing leadership up. The king will eventually back off pretty soon and then just what? Let everyone else fight. The army will get bigger and they'll have to continue to fight for him, to protect him. I also need men to plow the ground. By the way, Gideon, you got to go home after you were done being my judge and plow your ground. No, a king is going to have you plow his ground. He'll make them laborers, not for their farms, but for his. Aristocracy is born. But it already exists in every other nation around Israel. But now in this brand new nation of milk and honey, aristocracy is now born. Kings don't plow. Kings don't labor. Israel is no longer in business for themselves. They're in business for who? For the king. In 1 Kings, you'll see when Solomon comes along, in 1 Kings, and I'll talk a little bit about Solomon week after next. Okay? But in 1 Kings, Solomon appoints 12 governors. And you're thinking, wow, empowering leadership. He's delegating. That is so cool. You know, that's what an engaged leader should do is empower leaders, you know, to be able to lead. And you're thinking, 12 governors, okay, for you know, 11 and a half tribes. Yes, that sounds good. And then there's a line that says that they were appointed to procure the palace's food. Not to lead Israel. An entire governor from every tribe and region just to procure the palace's food. So that pretty much includes every able-bodied man that the king is about to rule over. He will what? He will take. He will take them. It's about to get worse. What's next? Who's next? He's taken your sons, now he will what? Now he'll take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. That food's got to be prepared. By the way, just to say perfumer, okay? It's not the king that wears the perfume. Guess who they perfume? And he usually doesn't have just one wife, does he? So it gets worse than this. It gets worse than this because almost immediately, it's not just to perform, to be in the kitchen and to make perfume. He's also taking them for what? As his wives and his concubines. Because by the way, that's how earthly kings show you that they're powerful. Why does every earthly king have to have multiple wives and multiple concubines? Because somehow, in an ancient mind, somehow, the more that I do there, the more virile I at least appear, the more power that I'm able to exercise. And it seems to exhibit itself in attacking the one person, the one entire group of people that have absolutely no power under the law. It's worse for who? It's worse for the women. I'm sorry, ladies, every time I come across this in the Bible, I told you all the way back in Genesis in the garden, ladies, you are going to get it in the teeth. It is a man's world. This world. You take your sons, take your daughters. He'll take people. He'll take them. You are now his subjects, if you will. And he doesn't stop there. He'll take the best of your what? The best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards. Give them to his courtiers. People that just are in court. People that a king has to court in order to remain in power. Ambassadors from other courts. They live up there. They have to be placated. They have to be fed. These are the things that he has to do. And it's the people that pay for it. He'll take 1/10 of your grain, your vineyards, give it to his officers and to his courtiers. The best, he says, is given to his court. The best, he says, is given to those servants. Your best is now his. And by the way, verse 15 should send a chill through you. Because when you think of 1/10, what do you think of? The king will demand a what? A tithe. And the reason he demands a tithe is because by the time he gets to where he can take all of this from the nation, he begins to be kind of worshipped like a god. Every king from around them is worshipped as a god. Nebuchadnezzar was worshipped as a god. Every Caesar will be worshipped as a god. God's telling them ahead of time, even your own kings will begin to feel about themselves this way. And while you're paying your tenth to the temple, I get another one. I get a tenth. Not only for what the material would be, but I get a tenth for the statement that it makes. God said, it's not that they don't want you, Samuel. They don't want me. The monarchy goes one step further in separating God from his children. The monarchy now puts another god in place, the king himself, the monarchical power itself. Another tenth. By the way, what's the fundamental principle of tithing to a God that loves us? What's the fundamental principle? What should be the only reason why you and I pay our tithe in worship to our God? Is that it all belongs to him. And because he loves us, he's only asking for a tenth. But the king says, no, it all belongs to me. And I'm going to take, even if you're still paying to God, I'm still going to take it. He doesn't stop there. He wants to own it all. He asked him. Samuel says, after a few years of this, by the way, just a couple of generations, he'll take your male and female slaves, the best of your cattle, the donkeys, to put them to his work. He'll take 1/10 of your flocks. You shall be his slaves. And he says, just after a few years of this, on that day, you will what? You will cry out because of your king. Not the enemies. Because of your king. Whom you chose for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you on that day. It's kind of like, well, this is what you wanted. This is what you think I'm like. So why should I answer you when you call to me when this whole thing goes south? And it's going to go south real quick. How many here think that you would have been convinced by Samuel's argument? You're one of the elders at Ramah that day. Would you have been convinced of this? No, I don't get too uppity with him. Because it said, the what? The people refused. There was not one who said, okay, guys, I think this is a bad idea. Not one. The people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel. They said, no. We are determined to have a king over us. We made up our minds before we even called you here, Samuel. So that we may also be like other nations, that our king may govern us and go out before us and fight our battles. It's okay, Samuel. We take into consideration what you said, but it is the price of doing business. We're willing to surrender everything that you just said. If you could keep our enemies off our backs. other kings win by oppressing. We're going to do what's natural. We're going to do what needs to be done. The only way to get oppression off your back is to go and do what? To oppress more. Give us the guy that's going to do that. And we don't care what it costs to get there. King has to oppress to be in power, to stay in power. He needs to eliminate rivals from his throne. And then he needs to be able to defeat others by oppressing them. This whole system is built, will be built, and will always be built on oppression. And what we don't understand is that there's a real human cost to this. A truly human cost to all of this. Death and destruction and poverty. All to be able to indulge these kings. This is what Samuel said the real problem is with having a king. Someone's going to have to pay for this. This is a human price. Not just goods and services. It's the people who will have to pay. The very children that God loves and delivered from slavery in Egypt. They now are asking for slavery to another king. Solomon, and like I said, we'll talk about this in 2 weeks, but Solomon looks at the whole thing that he was part of, that he generated, and he laments in Ecclesiastes at the end of his life, looking back on his reign and how he ruled. That's what Ecclesiastes is about. It's reflection. It's confession. But again, he says, again, I saw all the what? All the oppressions that are practiced under the sun. Look, the tears of the oppressed with who to comfort them. No one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power with no one to comfort them. Whenever he mentions oppression, he also mentions what? That they have no comforter. We'll talk about this in a couple weeks. Solomon, though, before he got into this, he thought he was going to be that. He believed he was going to be that comfort. And I'll share the verse where he says, I thought that my wisdom and everything was going to get me there, but I got there and I only could do what was done before. May accept, everybody accepts on this planet that oppression is inevitable, unavoidable under the sun. What upsets Solomon here the most is that no one seems to care. There is no one to comfort them. Israel demands a king. Why? So they could be like other nations. They're being oppressed by other nations. They think the formula is to oppress them. Those kings stayed on their throne. They stayed on their throne, and they come into our own land, and they oppress us. Unfortunately, the oppression of the own people, that the king's own people has to begin first before he begins to go over other borders and oppress others. God had in mind something different. He had in mind something different for Israel. He wanted him to be the ruler. And if I'm going to be the rulers that will truly represent me, and it goes back 2 weeks to our New Year's sermon, what does he want? Who does he want ruling his people? Not a king, but a what? A shepherd. It's the shepherds that he wants. God had in mind something different. By the way, the law gives a little bit of a glimpse. The law has a whole lot to do with not looking like how God would like to treat his children. But again, this whole thing that we walk when sometimes God may treat you because you're asking for it, because you believe that he's demanding this. But then sometimes the law just kind of creeps through, you know, that his love, his grace kind of pops up, you know, in the law itself. Our scripture reading was one of them. He writes into the law that says, you shall not deprive what? You shall not deprive a resident alien or an orphan of justice. You shall not take a widow's garment in pledge. By the way, the reason he says this in Deuteronomy at the end of the Pentateuch is because widows and orphans and aliens are not provided for under the law before. Legally. A widow or an orphan has no legal recourse in Israel. If the man dies and there is no male heir, guess where the widow and the orphan show up or end up? Somebody steps in, buys the dead man's property, and is under no obligation to take care of his widow or his orphan children. And by the way, the orphans are always daughters. Because the law says that if that was a son, she could hold on to it. Gives them no legal recourse. So God has to come in and say, all right, outside of the courts, outside of inheritance laws, outside of all that, you shall not deprive any of them. The three groups of people that the law does not cover. Remember, why? Why should you care for them? Because you were once a what? You were once a slave in Egypt. And the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore, I command you to do this. I did this for you. I want you now to go do it for the oppressed. You were oppressed. I redeemed you. Now go and don't oppress anyone else. In fact, relieve their oppression. When you reap your harvest, your field, forget a sheaf in the field. Don't go what? Don't go back. A whole sheaf of grain, not that big. It falls off the truck. You're not allowed to back the truck up. Leave it there. For who? For the wanderers, for the aliens, for the people wandering through. Otherwise, are they going to eat without stealing? No. This is theirs, God says. Go back and get it. Don't go back and get it. The orphan, the widow, the alien, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all your undertakings. When you beat your olive trees, don't strip what is left. You were only allowed to beat the trees once. And I don't know how long it was or anything else, but when you beat the trees, whatever fell down that first time, they said, that's it. Don't go back. Don't do it again. It shall be for who? It shall be for the oppressed. Gather the grapes of your vineyard. Don't clean what is left. It shall be for the oppressed, for the alien, for the orphan, for the widow. I don't know if you've ever seen a grapevine when it's ready to harvest. The leaves and the branches and everything are all covering it. You can't see everyone, and you're trying to do it fast. He said you're not allowed to go back and inspect. After you do it the first time, you can't go back to any bunches that you missed. Leave it there. We do know in another place, in Leviticus, where it says you weren't even allowed to harvest the edges of your field, out where the road would be. Don't even harvest it. Because that's for the oppressed. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I'm commanding you to do this. With God ruling, truly ruling, if this is His law, if this is His word, He's giving them at least a picture of what it would be like if He were truly ruling. Would there be any oppression? No. In fact, He said, we're here to relieve the oppression. You think King Adonai Bezek told all of his farmers in his nation that you didn't harvest everything? You think that they lived by this? No. They would care for each other. They would care for the weak. All because they were supposed to remember that they were once oppressed too. You should know what it feels like. Israel was never to be ruled by a king. They were to be ruled by what? In Numbers 12, Moses is describing his nearing the end of his life. And he's asking God for his successor to lead Israel. And he says, he said in Deuteronomy, he says, you'll raise up a prophet like me. And what was Moses to the people? a shepherd. Who are you going to raise up? And I don't know if it's because of his sense of humor or whatever, God picks Joshua. We don't know what he does. Okay, it doesn't say out loud that he's a shepherd, but he just picks Joshua. We don't know what he did or what he does, but he does say this about him. He says, "Let the Lord," Moses said, "Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint someone over the congregation who shall go out before them and come in before them and shall lead them out and bring them in." What's Moses describing? That's just what you do with the sheep. You lead them out. You bring them in. So that the congregation of the Lord may not be like what? May not be like sheep without a shepherd. So the role is then passed on to this guy, this kid. The one who, by the way, is kind of like at the head of the line of the eavesdroppers. All the elders, when the cloud came down on the mountain and God would let everybody listen, okay, the whole camp would be back where their camp is. The Sanhedrin of the 70 elders would be a little bit closer. Joshua seemed to always find his way up as close as he could possibly get. As a matter of fact, when he comes down, when Moses comes down in the golden calf incident, Joshua's actually climbed halfway up the mountain. He meets him coming down. That's all we know about this kid. And that he was one of the spies. He was one of the original spies that went into the land. And he and Caleb are the only ones when they come out saying, "We got to do this, guys." That's all we know about him. As a matter of fact, his name wasn't Joshua when he was sent in as a spy. Just before he sent in as a spy, Moses changed his name to Joshua. His name was Hosea. His name was Hosea. He changed his name to Joshua, which means Yahweh saves. So we may not be explicitly told that he's a shepherd, but his name is Joshua. Joshua is Yeshua in Hebrew. It's Jesus in Greek, which makes it Jesus in English. God is actually saying, at least the guy with my name is going to be Israel's shepherd, Moses. And I'm sure Moses laying on his deathbed, as soon as he picked him, I think Moses relaxed. But the prophets will come along and say, Micah says, "I said, listen, you heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, should you not know justice? You who hate the good and love the evil, who tear the skin off my people and the flesh off their bones." In other words, now the shepherds, who aren't shepherds, but they're kings, they're actually feeding off the sheep. They're actually butchering the sheep rather than caring for them. He says, "Mortal, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy to them," Ezekiel will say, "to the shepherds, thus says the Lord God, woe, you shepherds of Israel, who have been feeding yourselves. Should not shepherds do what? Feed the sheep." So God began his plan. He says, "I'll do it." Joshua is just a precursor to it. At least Joshua has the name God saves. He tells Ezekiel, "I'll save my flock, and they shall no longer be ravaged. I will judge between sheep and sheep. I'll set up over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he shall feed them. He shall feed them and be their shepherd." By the way, Ezekiel writes, during the exile to Babylon, David's been dead for quite a while. He's not talking about David. He's talking about the son of David, isn't he? He's not talking about Solomon. Because Solomon's dead too. But the good shepherd concept was associated with Moses and Joshua and David first. So these concepts clearly apply by the time that we get to the New Testament. They apply only to him. The law indeed was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. As I pointed out, the law doesn't necessarily take care of the oppressed. Israel was supposed to come up with that on their own. Israel was supposed to say, you know what? The law isn't taking care of these people, but God took care of us when we were oppressed. We should be taking care of those who are oppressed. No one has ever seen God. It is God, the only Son, who is close to the Father's heart, who has made him known. The Good Shepherd concept is God as shepherd, God as ruler. He was the prophet that was raised up like Moses. He's the king in the line of David. Jesus is the Good Shepherd. So think of this. As we consider who we worship, who we bow down to, what we think kingdom and power really is. We think about where we've come from to here, whether or not a government on this planet can be ruled by a shepherd, let alone the shepherd. I am the good shepherd, he says. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. If you want to know the difference between an earthly king and the king that Jesus came to be, is whether or not he's willing to what? Whether or not he's willing to sacrifice. Whether or not he's willing to lay down. Whether or not he's willing to surrender his power rather than increase it. Whether he's willing to condescend, as Paul says about Jesus in Ephesians. Condescend, even to the point of the cross. The shepherd's willing to die for the sheep. On this planet, sheep have to die for the king. The kingdom where we're at, no more oppression. Because we were taught that you don't face oppression and cure oppression with more oppression. We cure it with willing to sacrifice, as has been done for us. And it's easy to talk about. I understand that. It's a whole lot easier to talk about than it is to go and what? To go and do it. But maybe if you want to put any words in your head this week as you're trying to condescend and to bring power within and put it under rather than exercise it over somebody, the one thing you might want to remember is you were once slaves in Egypt and I delivered you. Now go. After next, let's talk to one of the kings. Let's talk to one of the guys that actually tried to do this, and let him tell you what his experience was.